and you don't want to be dead.
You can't be that good.
Let's go!
What's all this then?
This is a crazy town, isn't it? I think we ought to just get out of here.
No, no, this is your horse.
Can't you see this horse loves me?
Making a big mistake.
That's what I told him.
If I brought a pretty lady like that into a place like this, I'd stay close.
I think you got a point, Emmett. Maybe I better stay here with her.
And we're gonna give you a fair trial, followed by a first-class hanging.
I had enough of what ain't right.
Some people think they can push you around, but it's only true if you let it be.
I don't want you to get hurt. You want one of these? This ought to do.
Let's get up!
Hanging around with you is no picnic.
Pictures presents Kevin Klein.
Get some clothes on.
Scott Glenn.
You know, hanging around with you is no picnic.
Rosanna Arquette.
I think I'll ride along with the lady here.
John Cleese.
Today, my jurisdiction ends here.
Kevin Costner.
Hi, guys!
Brian Dennehy.
What's going on?
Watch.
Danny Glover.
This ought to do.
Jeff Goldblum.
Excuse me. Sheriff, I'm a gambler who'd like to run an honest game here in your town.
And Linda Hunt.
Here's the good stuff.
May it last a long time.
In Lawrence Kasdan's Silverado.
Used to be a peaceful town.
Get ready for the ride of your life.
Welcome, everybody, to the Lawrence Kasdan Power Hour. It's not quite the Lawrence Kasdan Power Hour. We're going to be discussing Silverado, which is one of our favorite films that Tim thought was fine. And we're also going to be discussing our top five Danny Glover performances. I am joined with Tim Fugli. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I mean, I'm fine. I watched an okay movie today.
Thank you. But, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Okay, good. And then I'm also joined with Kyle. Kyle, how are you?
Hey, doing great.
Good. And then we are joined with a special guest who might be a downer when we talk about certain Lawrence Kasdan films, but he promised to behave. We're joined with Jason Gallen from the Phi Effect podcast.
Yes, Owen, thank you. And I'm not going to be any more of a downer than Tim is, trust me.
No, okay. That's a good thing. So, like I led with, we're going to discuss Silverado, Danny Glover. I'm sure we're going to get into Westerns, and I'm fairly confident we're going to be discussing the canon that is Lawrence Kasdan's films, because I think the guy was the best filmmaker of the 80s. A lot of people shit on the 80s when it comes to the movies, and it's like, after the 70s was over, fuck the 80s, and then the 90s happened with Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez and all those guys. But, I mean, you got Oliver Stone out of the 80s, you got Kasdan, and then probably 40 other people that I can't think of off the top of my head. And just to get it out of the way really quick, because I know I caught flack for this earlier, Lawrence Kasdan did write Empire Strikes Back, The Force Awakens, and Raiders of the Lost Ark. So I just wanted to get the Kasdan Star Wars connection out of the way so I don't have to bring that up later.
Well, yeah. And Return of the Jedi.
And Return of the Jedi. I'm sorry. Yeah. You're correct. So,
and co-wrote.
I think so.
You share credit on all of
co-writing that with Lucas.
I know with The Force Awakens, he co-wrote it with Abrams. So,
right.
Which is probably writing it yourself anyway.
I mean, more
wow,
than,
kitty got more, claws up
more
there.
Than, more than likely.
Okay,
we don't have to go into Abrams right away, but I will say that I was very underwhelmed with him being selected to do The Force Awakens, and then after I watched the movie, I was a believer. So, there's that. He's gonna get a lot of slack from me from this point forward with The Force Awakens, or The Force Remakens, as Kyle Jonathan likes to call it.
You should trademark that shit, man. That's great.
Indeed. I still love it, but I do call it The
Force Remakens. I can't wait for the shitty play of words for The Last Jedi and Empire Strikes Back. That's gotta be coming down the pipeline. You better start thinking about that now. All right.
Yeah. Somewhere. Yep.
So anyway, I don't even know where to begin with this film.
I'll start.
Okay, go ahead.
I think, aside from nostalgia, I think what really is kind of charming about Silverado is it's basically, like, I was reading a couple of different, you know, reviews just trying to prep, and I saw people saying it's like a revisionist Western. I didn't get that at all. I thought it was more of an homage. Like, if you take, like, each individual sequence, like if you split it up, it's like they're all just great things about the genre. You know, like there's the heroes coming together on the quest, right? And then there's the corrupt lawman in the town, and the saloon sequence, and the jailbreak, and the high noon showdown. You know, I feel like it was kind of like a love letter. And like for people who aren't into Westerns, I feel like it's a great kind of gateway to approach the giants of the genre. I was reading, and I think a lot of critics were a little harsh because of that. I think they were like, well, it doesn't really do anything new for the genre, and I could see that argument, but I think it's a tribute. It's not cynical. It's not overly violent. Like, you know, when people get shot, it's like one shot and they just hit the ground and it doesn't linger on the violence really. But it's there. You know, it's still in the undercurrent, that kind of lawless, like a Jeff Fahey's really menacing as Tyree. He does a really great job with that. But, I think it's handled with genuine care. And it just tells, you know, a fun epic. There's virtually no suspense in the film. You know how it's going to go down, but at the same time, you're enjoying it because the characters are fun and they're clearly having fun with it. The costuming's great. Sound design is one of the things that really stuck out with me. The sound was really good. But I just think in general, it's like every scene he tried to get the most bang for his buck out of the Western, you know, like we're going to have this scene and we're going to have the, and it's going to be this from, and sure you can say it's copying, but I really just feel like it was an homage. That's kind of what I came away from, and a loving one at that.
Yeah, I agree. I'm surprised you found any reviews out there that would call it some kind of revisionist Western. I mean, that's its own thing, obviously.
But actually,
that is not what Silverado is. Silverado is a big, sloppy, wet kiss to the genre. You know,
It's on the DVD case.
Is that right?
Like the quote is
Stern.
Yeah, like Kasdan's revisionist. That's why it was kind of stuck in my head. But anyways, go on. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just thought.
I'm just going to say, I was really struck. I was saying to Frank earlier. My memory of the film when it came out was that it was a little goofier, and I think that may have been, Costner obviously brings a fair amount of the humor of the film is generated by his character. And I kind of had this idea in my head that was going to define that it was, not that it was going to be Blazing Saddles, but that it was going to be a little goofier than it was, you know, and when Kevin Kline shows up and, when John Cleese shows up, I'm like, all right, I'm ready for the funny stuff, guys. And it's like, Kline is in full-on Gary Cooper mode, you know?
Yeah.
He's just a straight-up good dude. And Cleese, I think he has maybe one or two snide lines, but he never drops a joke. He's just like, this is my fucking job, and I'm going to get through it, and you guys are making it more difficult, so get out of here. And you know, I was just like, you're really not going to play this for laughs, and they didn't. Even Costner is not overdone by any means. So I was surprised by that, and I was pleasantly surprised by that. It was cool.
Very nice. Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, you guys touched on a couple of things. The revisionist thing, yeah, it's very confusing to think of this as a revisionist Western. It very it in most cases seems like it's going against kind of the revisionist stuff that was going on. It has the look, like visually it kind of looks like a revisionist thing, like what, you know, Clint Eastwood was doing during this time period. But as far as the tone and the feel of it, it feels much more like a classical Western. It even has, right in the opening sequence, Scott Glenn Emmett framed against the doorway in a very, you know, John Ford-esque, Searchers-esque image that right away lets you know that, you know, we're going backwards here. We're not trying to move the genre forward. We're going to, as you guys are saying, kind of just embrace it and kind of wallow in it and have some fun with it. And that's the other thing that Tim mentioned is the humor. Because this is it's a very funny movie, but it is all character-driven. It's not gags. There's never, even with Costner, who is the most outrageous, obviously, with this kind of dim-witted brother, isn't, you know, they're not gags. They're just, they're character-based jokes, and it handles them so well. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I grew up watching this on VHS, but I watched this after I watched all the Ford movies with my dad and the Peckinpah movies with my dad, and Silverado was different, and it's a lot what Kyle was saying. It's not a direct homage to any movie, and most scenes aren't a direct homage to too many other scenes from seminal Western films. It's just a love letter to the genre when Hollywood wasn't even making Westerns at the time. I mean, even Clint Eastwood, what? Like, around the same time, it was like Pale Rider?
Clint Eastwood was fucking around with orangutans around that time. I mean, he wasn't on a horse much at that point.
He was always sneaking Westerns in there, though. Outlaw Josie Wales, Pale Rider.
Right, but I mean, I don't even think Pale Rider's like a conventional Western, right? Because
no, exactly. It's more of an revisionist Western,
right?
But which Kasdan kind of takes the look. He wants it to seem like a modern Western or, you know, 80s modern. But again, the tone and the, you know, where it lies thematically is much more akin to classic Westerns.
Right, and a couple of things struck me when I watched it again. I actually watched it on my Criterion Laserdisc, which was a fun experience because I'm old school slash pretentious when it comes to stuff like that. Plus, I love buying Criterion Laserdiscs. I think it's so much fun every time I can find one.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and you know, I have two Laserdisc players, so it's pretty cool. But what I was really struck by was I forgot how stacked the cast was. Even when I look it up on IMDb, I mean, this has to be maybe his best ensemble. I mean,
yeah.
Holy shit, you got everybody from fucking John Cleese to Jeff Fahey to the seminal Kevin Klein I mean, Linda Hunt, what?
Yeah.
How's Linda Hunt even in this movie? And my favorite thing when I was rewatching this, and what makes me want to go back to it again relatively soon, is how much I miss Brian Dennehy on film, because I don't think many actors have the charisma and affability that he has, especially when he's playing the villain. And, you know, I think Knight of Cups was the last thing I saw Dennehy in, but, I mean, that really doesn't count because he really doesn't do much in that movie. I should say actors really don't do a whole lot in a Terrence Malick movie. Even though I love Knight of Cups, I think Knight of Cups is great, but Dennehy's just so awesome, man. I mean, Jesus Christ, he straddles the line of being affable, like I said, but also menacing, because you know he's the big bad of the movie. You know the movie is gonna end as soon as he shows up, and he has one of the best entrances ever when Kevin Klein's kissing his horse, and the sheriff's like, you know, how do I know it's your horse? It's like, can't you see this horse loves me? My name's underneath the saddle. And it's like, what's your name? And then Paden, P-A-D-E-N. And then Dennehy just fucking struts into the movie with, like, his furry collar. And he's just, what makes Dennehy work so well is he's a fucking big dude to begin with, and he just has this huge persona on screen. But to get back to what I was saying, you know the movie's going to end as soon as Dennehy enters the film with a duel between Klein and him. And that duel is one of my favorite cowboy duels at the end of the movie. It's so great. And like you were saying, Kyle, it's not hammy. It's not over the top. Like, I love Django Unchained and Hateful Eight because those are direct homages to classic Westerns, but they're over the top violence because that's what Tarantino does. But these are great. I mean, it's like Dennehy gets gunned down, and it's like just a pivot and a fall. And it's so cinematic, man. It's so great. And it's interesting seeing some of these actors in the film. Dennehy pulls off the cowboy. You're sold instantly. Scott Glenn, there's like no question. It's like you see Scott Glenn in fucking leather, and you're like, yeah, totally. Kevin Kline is almost a hard sell for me, even though I've seen this movie a bunch of times. It's just like, when I think of Kevin Kline, I think of either Sophie's Choice, A Fish Called Wanda, or
Fish
The
Called
Ice
Wanda.
Storm. And it's just like, look at this beard he has, and it's like he's kind of funny, but he's playing it incredibly straight. And that's what makes his character work so well. And then you got Jeff Goldblum is like this weird-looking pimp dude.
Yeah.
You know?
I love that character.
And then Jeff Fahey with the eyeliner. And it totally works because he's just this bad motherfucker in the movie that's just, you know, he's a horrible person. He's like Jack Palance from Shane. You know, that's who Jeff Fahey is. Just a little less stoic than Jack Palance was in Shane. Kevin Costner's amazing. Danny Glover, which we're going to get to a huge gush fest on him in a little bit. I love the Glovers in this movie. And what the hell else was I going to... Oh, Tim brought it up. John Cleese. Yep. I don't even know how that works.
I know how it works.
Tell us.
Because he's bigger than Glover. That scene needed someone who had the stature to... Danny Glover. I mean, it's funny you mentioned physicality already with Brian Dennehy, because I was going to bring it up later with Glover, but we might as well go into it. But that's exactly what I thought during that scene. I'm like, why would you have John Cleese here, this English comedian? But he has like this power about him too, and the size of, you know, a Danny Glover or a Brian Dennehy, excuse me. So he can do this scene, this one intense scene with Glover, and pull it off and seem like a force unto himself and someone who would be respected and not mess with.
It takes a couple beats, but once you get into that scene and his role in that scene, I think you're absolutely right. He's got to play against type, obviously, because everyone's expecting the Minister of Silly Walks to do something crazy. But I was ready for the joke. Okay, what's the gag going to be here? And the gag is, fuck you, there's no gag.
Exactly.
He's the sheriff, and he's got a job to do, and he's not real pleased with how his day is going so far. And, you know, it's great. I think it's wonderful kind of stunt casting.
I love how his character's a gray character, too, because he struts in there, and it's just like, you guys are picking on the fucking black guy. Like, cut this shit out. You know I don't like this shit. You know I don't tolerate this shit. But at the same time, Glover, Glenn, and Kline bring this fucking ruckus into town, so it's like, you guys got to get the fuck out, because I'm the lawman, and I'm keeping the peace. So, sorry this shit happened, I'm not going to tolerate racism, but get the fuck out. And that's what I really like about his character.
I like that he's the only professional in the town. Like the scene where he's playing chess and then turns the board, even though he's sitting across the
board. That's a pretty awesome scene.
And then when they're like, he's missing us, and he's like, no, he's hit everything he's aimed at. And then, like, you know, the hat falls off, and he's like, my jurisdiction ends here. I'm going home. See you later.
Right.
You know, like, just I like that everyone from Dennehy all the way down, the killers, if you will, you know, the professionals, they all know each other, which is very reminiscent of Robert B. Parker's novels, like Appaloosa, where, like, there's this kind of, like, mythology between the gunslingers. They have their own kind of, like, reputation system, I guess, if you will. So, like, they all know instantly, like, oh, well, all right, if this is, you know, like, the best line of the, you know, the most famous line of the film, like, I don't want to kill you, you don't want to be dead. Like, and I liked how that, like, how he won't let the dog story go, how that, you know, keeps coming up. Along with the $13 that he left, you know, like it's like they have these kind of like never ending, almost like pirates is kind of how I'd put it. They have these like never ending kind of systems of debts.
Yeah, you know? There's lots of honor and dishonor amongst thieves in the movie, and there is kind of quietly. I like the fact that he doesn't beat you over the head with a lot of backstory, but kind of quietly sets out really a huge ecosystem of bad guys in the movie. There's a lot of bad guys in there.
And fortunately, Kasdan learned well from Star Wars because he made sure that, you know, the good guys never miss a shot and the bad guys can't hit the side of a barn with a shotgun. but I loved all the villains. And, you know, like you're talking about with Fahey, he doesn't really, you know, I can't remember the character's name at this
Tyree.
Point.
Tyree.
But Tyree, he doesn't have that many lines, but you just know, you know, he sells you on it. And most of the other nasties running around, the guy with the eye patch, you know, the guy who gets shot in his hand. Boy, when he goes after Glover's sister in the jail, that's creepy. Unfortunately, rectified very quickly by Glover and his sister. But yeah, I think the villains are great in it.
I want to
bring just real quick, Kyle, before you jump in. I wanted to bring up how you kept bringing up, but how you mentioned that Dennehy keeps bringing up the $13. To him, I love that because I also felt that was Dennehy establishing dominance over.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin Kline's character, where it's just like, look, like, we respect each other, but I'm higher up on the food chain. So, like, this is my show, and you're just staying here. You know, I'm letting you live here because we have a history, but don't fuck around. But anyway, go ahead with what you're going to
say. Oh, I was just going to say, speaking of villains, you have Ray Baker as the Dennehy's boss.
Mm-hmm.
He's the Total Recall guy, the salesman in Total Recall that like sells Arnold Schwarzenegger's character.
Oh, yeah,
it took me a second. I was like, oh my god, that's the Blue Sky on Mars guy, you know. So
the cattle rancher or whatever, the money guy.
And also, the only villain to actually shoot one of the main guys. He hits Glenn in the leg in the final showdown. But I just thought that was a funny thing because I kept trying. I was like, where do I know this guy? Because he has the facial hair, so I couldn't place it. And then I was like, it's the Total Recall guy.
And then what's his face from fucking Home Improvement? Wilson the neighbor is Scott Glenn's brother-in-law.
Oh, that's right.
Wilson
that's
the neighbor.
A good eye right there.
You see his face. I don't even know what that guy looks like because you never see his face in fucking Home Improvement, but he's got the big-ass stash. No, I mean, and then there's a lot of people. What's his name? I'm going to fuck his name up because I'm going to get confused with the English actor. Michael Gammon is in
James Gammon.
I'm sorry, James Gammon, who's awesome, and I love you to death. I don't know if he's been in another Kasdan film, but, you know, you get him, and then you get the fucking, what's the guy from Tango and Cash that with the shitty Australian accent in that movie?
Brian Thompson?
Is it Brian Thompson? Yeah.
It's not Brian Brown.
But,
that was FX.
You know what I did want to bring up was the one thing that struck me when I rewatched this movie was the plot point, or I should say the storyline with Rosanna Arquette goes nowhere.
Yeah. Totally superfluous. That's shoving a girl in there because, they want a girl in there.
Right. Let's get the girl in here with, like, we're kind of setting up a love triangle between her, Kevin Kline, and Scott Glenn, and then it just doesn't go anywhere because...
I don't get the impression at any point that Glenn or Kline really care that much. I think they'd rather be riding around with their boys shooting people.
It's ridiculous.
You know, it really does feel shoehorned in there, and that's too bad. I love the Arquette gals. Yeah. So I was hoping when I saw her in the cast they were going to do more with her. But, yeah, she, you know, generic love interest number one.
Yes,
totally. That's about it.
Quick correction, it's Brian James was the name, not Brian Thompson. Brian James. Brian Thompson is the killer in Cobra.
The guy from the X-Files. He's the Martian killer.
From the X-Files.
Kindred the Embarrassed, TV show.
God, Cobra.
Tim, you're totally right about that relationship. And it's so weird, too, because it's like Kline goes after her, and he's like, I'm not really into her. And he just kind of passes her off.
She wants to work hard. I don't like that, you know. He's like,
I'm sure I could find it, like, find the script to it, because I imagine there was something more to that, and then it was just one of those things that either they didn't shoot or in post-production it was like, okay, the runtime's getting a little long, and we need to trim some fat out of this, so let's just cut the story out. I mean, it's not really
over
a big
2
deal.
Hours, which at the time was a pretty long runtime. I mean, in the mid-80s, they didn't make too many that were that long. But the whole movie, I think Kasdan makes a conscious decision to make the dialogue fairly sparse, you know, as in most good Westerns it is.
And I kind of feel like her character suffers from that the most, that the that's where the sparseness really shows, almost just a gaping hole there, where there just wasn't enough written in. And like you said, maybe it's all on the editing room floor. I don't know. But I appreciated the sparseness a lot of the time. Just didn't really work with that whole aspect of it. But it's a very small part of the movie, too, so it's not really that big a distraction.
Right. It's nowhere near, like, a major plot point. I don't think it detracts. It doesn't add much to it. I mean, aside from looking at Rosanna Arquette, because she still is gorgeous. But, yeah, it really doesn't, I guess, take away anything. It was just something I noticed upon rewatch. It was kind of like, huh, okay.
Well, even with her responding to who you assume is her boyfriend at the beginning, you know, he gets aced, and everybody's just
right.
I don't
so
think
they're
there's
like
another
setting
line
it
of
up.
Dialogue about it, you know. It's just like I mean, you want to see him get aced anyway. I totally knew why they put him on the mission to go get the money box. So it was like, yeah, this is how they're going to take care of this prick, and they do. But you know, she doesn't even say anything about it when they get back. They don't. And again, maybe cutting room floor, but there's not even a line about it. So that was pretty funny.
Yeah, the only line is from is it? It's not Mal. Maybe it's I think it's Kevin Costner actually.
Yeah, it is.
Her husband's body's not even cold yet.
Right, yeah.
There is that one. He just walks off. He's like, yep, I don't.
And nobody really raises an eyebrow about it either.
As far as like female leads, I mean, it's really Linda Hunt's film anyways.
Oh, absolutely.
For sure.
You know, and I think my suspicion is that played heavily into that decision, because I think maybe they were like, well, we need, you know, like a contrast to her character or something, have, you know, like the quote-unquote love interest, but then Linda Hunt was like, well, let me show you how it's done. And just blew, you know, she's
has an immediate chemistry with Klein that's kind of amazing. And just the fact that they bond so quickly over the fact that I think they can just sense they're two good people. They're good people in a not really great town, in a not really great land at this point. So they just kind of come together like that. And yeah, I agree. That's the genius of Linda Hunt right there.
I was, you know, I've been thinking about this ever since we started talking about it, and I don't know which one of you mentioned it, but for as somewhat lean as this film is, they do, or I should say Kazan does, an incredibly good job of giving, I think, Tim, you were talking about this, each character, or I should say Glenn and Costner put together, each of their stories is pretty much well fleshed out.
Mm-hmm.
Without having to do anything. And I feel like if this movie was going to be made now, even though they don't make Westerns anymore, there would just be flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that this movie doesn't need it. It would be cool to see, like, about the story with the dog, or Scott Glenn and Jake, or Mal back in the day. But I do like how the movie is very straightforward, no flashbacks, and it's all just told through dialogue.
Yeah, the backstories come for pretty much everybody, but they're not rushed. They're not, well, we've just introduced Danny Glover, we need to tell you his whole backstory right now.
Right.
You know, they take their sweet time with that. His main backstory when he marches in is that he wants a whiskey and a real bed to sleep in. And they, you know, that's all you know about him for a while. And they do the same with Klein. You know, they do a nice job with the dog story because Dennehy, you know, and one of his cohorts cracks the joke early on. You find the dog yet. And then don't circle back to it until much later. And I think that what you're pointing out is something that I really felt when I was watching the movie, too, which is the whole tell me versus show me. And I think that instead of having to show a lot of backstory, like in a flashback or whatnot, the screenplay is strong enough that you are told through action and through sparse dialogue here and there and not just kind of drilled over the head with a flashback or a paragraph, I am stepping into the bar and I shall tell my tale kind of shit. So, you know, it's a good script from Kasdan, and it's a sneaky good script that way.
I think with the backstory, too, there's enough left unsaid where you can wonder about the characters and maybe not see Klein necessarily as, you know, all good or anyone, really. I think everyone kind of occupies this kind of gray area where they've done things that they don't, you know, aren't proud of, or, you know, maybe they've been to jail. We know that Emmett's been to jail. We know he's killed a man. You know, he says it's self-defense. He did his time. But there's always enough there to let it be a little enigmatic. So you can fill in the blanks, which I think, you know, all good movies do. They'll give you something to do.
Yeah, Dennehy even mentions that about Klein at one point, doesn't he? There's a line in there about how he's just never quite sure what you're going to stick up for.
Right.
And that makes you, while he's clearly a noble guy in the context of the two-hour film, it does kind of make you wonder, has he made some pretty poor decisions in the past on who he has decided to support? And obviously he has, because he was running with Dennehy.
Exactly. What exactly does it mean to ride with Cobb and that crew? We never really know.
Other than the dog story, which is kind of, you know, which is my favorite, probably one of my favorite scenes. Because that really encapsulates exactly what you're saying. It's like, because he says he didn't even like the dog.
Right. I love how Klein ends up in that scene too. He just kind of walks in to get to hear the end of it, and he doesn't. You know, he's not offended. He's not pissed. He just plays along and is, you know, even funnier than Cobb is in telling the story. You know,
It left me.
Yes. The look on his face. I know this. It's a subtle performance, but this is a brilliant comic performance from Kevin Klein. He's hilarious in this damn movie.
Right, and to get back to whoever brought it up, but like what was Peyton and Cobb doing when they were like running with Tyree? And you can pretty much gather that it's nothing good.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, they're burning down, you know, they're burning down small villages for fucking cattle ranchers, or, you know, they're doing the bad bounty hunter shit. And I always looked at this as the story as it is Peyton's road to redemption, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, and then he takes Cobb down at the end, and it's just like all's forgiven, and it's like, hey, we're all back together. Let's go off into the sunset and save the next village.
He becomes still, you know, stronger moral ground in the city.
Right. What the fuck was I going to say? God damn it.
Do you get, you know, when Klein, when Klein at the end, obviously he's the sheriff and he's kind of completed that arc you're talking about. Do you think there's any chance in the world he's going to get together with Arquette at that point? Not to beat a dead horse here, but it's just funny going back to that because, that would seem to be the natural thing to do, but maybe this is more of the script being sneaky good again, in that both he and Glenn, you know, you keep waiting for Scott Glenn to say, come with me. And he kind of does, but he kind of doesn't. And then Klein's going to stay in town. He's going to run Silverado, but, you know, there's not a lot of lightning going on between him and Arquette. Do you guys think that's supposed to be there, that kind of vagueness? Do you think there's just a big thumbs down, it's not going to happen?
I think they were trying to keep Emmett as the kind of laconic drifter with his last lines with her, and she's like, I can't remember the exact quote, but essentially it's like, well, next time you're in town, stop by, and he's like, I definitely will, kind of thing, and then, you know, rides off. I didn't even... At that point, I don't think Peyton is even in, you know.
Yeah. I would agree. I think honestly, Peyton, he seems more likely to end up with like Mal's sister than someone like Roseanne Arquette. You know, someone who likes the smell of a saloon.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That is his favorite smell in the world.
It is. It's his favorite place to be.
Indeed.
Yeah, put away a serious amount of whiskey in that movie, too. That's another thing I give mad props for, that one scene where he's just sitting there with Hunt, and they're going back and forth, and that amount, like every shot almost, it seemed, lower and lower until they've got an empty bottle, and then they've got the special bottle, and that's black, so you can't see in there. But, and of course, once action calls, they snap right to it. But I appreciated that about Klein's character for sure.
I might be the only person that gives a shit about this, but I always found it kind of interesting that William Hurt wasn't in the movie. Because I think that was the first movie that Hurt, and that was the first movie Kasdan made without Hurt. Mm-hmm. And it was Hurt and Kasdan for the 80s, and then he found Kevin Klein, and then, I mean...
My guess, looking at the years, because that's the same exact year that Kiss of the Spider-Woman came out. So my guess is there was a scheduling conflict. Hurt decided to go for the artier project, said, you know, and I don't know if they had it out. Yeah, well, exactly. You can't argue with the results.
I mean,
They
did work together again in I Love You to Death, which I think William Hurt's fucking phenomenal. I think I Love You to Death is just a great film to begin with.
So do I. Accidental Tourist, too, was before, just after Silverado.
Oh, it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So never mind then.
And like
so they have four collaborations.
And Big Chill is where Klein and Hurt and.
Right. That's where everything happened. I forgot.
I kind of wonder. Scott Glenn isn't really a regular player for Kasdan,
no,
so I wonder if that. I wonder if that part was written with Hurt in mind, and then. Didn't work out schedule-wise, and they grabbed Glenn. I'm glad they grabbed Glenn. That's a great way to start the movie.
Oh, yeah. I agree. I love William Hurt.
I was like,
that gun flip,
you have my attention.
Five.
Yeah.
I mean, William Hurt's one of my all-time favorite actors. I love him and everything I've seen him in, but I mean, I can't imagine him playing the Gary Cooper cowboy. Or not the Gary Cooper. I don't even know who he would be. You know, the John Wayne.
Or Eastwood, Glenn's character kind of reminds me of Eastwood a little bit. But yeah, no, I agree. But he's such a good actor, I'm sure he would have rocked it if he'd had the part. But it does kind of make you want to research that a little bit more and see if that's what Kasdan was originally thinking for his casting.
If I was going to replace a role with Hurt in this movie, I would have to say give him the slick role.
When you were leading up with that, that would be... You're 100% right. I think Goldblum is so out of place in this movie, it works. It's like John Cleese is so out of place in this movie, it works. But William Hurt would have rocked the fuck out of that slick part. You're right.
He totally could have.
He would have. He would have been more, I guess, suiting for the role. But I fucking love it. I love the knife in the boot. I love the fucking Derringer.
The holdout,
right. You just know the character is incredibly shitty just by the way he looks.
Yeah, I love him too, although I feel like there's so many great relationships and characters in this movie that his is one that I think kind of, like, the motivation kind of gets lost for him. Like, why exactly does he side with the sheriff? I mean, just because he's a scumbag, you know, gambler.
He's a hair underwritten. I think that's fair to say. He is a hair underwritten. And it's nice because it's a little vague for a while. You're not sure if he's going to be an ally or not. But once he's not, he's not. And then that's all you need to know about him, apparently.
Well, also, I think that casting Goldblum just immediately adds smarminess to that character. Because that was before, like, Jurassic Park, and that was before, everybody loved Jeff Goldblum. And so it's like he became this pop culture icon like he is now. I mean, thinking back to The Big Chill, he's the shittiest character. He's essentially kind of the same character he was in The Big Chill. I mean, he's the most... He's unlikable in The Big Chill.
He's an opportunist.
He's an opportunist in The Big Chill. He's an opportunist in Silverado. The Fly came out after
86.
Right, and I mean, he's an opportunist in The Fly. I mean, he played the smarmy asshole forever, and he was a little shitty in Jurassic Park, but then you ended up liking him, and then in Lost World, he's just this fucking hero all of a sudden. But, you know, I think that's a testament to casting, and I think that's what makes Kasdan work so well as a filmmaker, because you just cast these people and they're immediately fucking... The characters are immediately set. Which I guess I'm kind of contradicting myself a little bit with, like, John Cleese being cast in the film, but I mean, you know...
It snaps into it fast, though. You're right.
Right, but I mean, like, Scott Glenn. It's like the opening scene of the movie is fucking amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's amazing, and it's Scott Glenn, and it's instantly believable. Because he's just a badass. He's just a hard ass. I mean, Scott Glenn was a fucking hard ass when he was in Apocalypse Now, and he didn't even have any dialogue. And fucking Urban Cowboy, he's that guy you just don't want to fuck with. That's what I always think of whenever I see Scott Glenn in a movie.
I have to ask a quick Scott Glenn aside here. Did you watch The Leftovers this week?
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. It was just an all Scott Glenn episode.
It was an all Scott Glenn episode.
It was fantastic.
I've been priming Kyle for this because he hasn't seen the series and he's watched the show, or you haven't seen the series but you've read the book.
I read the novel, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's as soon as I finish Black Sails, it is
that's the next one. I think you'll like it better than the book. And I'll end the aside
but I read
the book too, and yeah, I think
it's
better.
I don't know, man. I don't want to digress too much, but the second season I still am not sold on it.
That's the best.
Oh, fuck that second season.
International Assassin is one of my favorite television episodes ever.
It's like Damian Lindelof, however the fuck you say his name.
Uh-huh.
Who's
probably
found,
a big Lawrence Kasdan fan. I'll bet he watches Grand Canyon like once a week and cries.
No, this is what happened. He found David Lynch's notes for Twin Peaks episodes on some website or some fucking storage container, and that's what he made season two out of.
Oh. Have you seen Lost? He's been doing this kind of crap forever. It's just more what he does.
Yeah, I haven't seen Lost, but I know everybody who loves it bitches about how it ends, and that's where I think The Leftovers is going.
Mm. Well, it's probably going to end vague. That's probably true. But anyway, we're diverting probably a bit much here.
Anyway,
so.
it was Scott Glenn Gush Fest.
Yes.
But anyway, so moving on from Silverado a little bit, what is your guys' assessment of Lawrence Kasdan overall?
Well, it's Dreamcatcher and everything else, right? I think we were talking about that before we started recording.
Dreamcatcher, no, French kiss or bust.
I think, you know, I feel for the guy because I think this happens to filmmakers and creative types and even actors in Hollywood all the time. I think he hit a bit of a rough spot box office-wise, and I think all of a sudden, you know, he stopped getting jobs, and I think it's a real pity because, as we were talking about prior to the call here, he was the top of the heap in Hollywood for the 80s and for a good chunk of the 90s, too. He was very deft at jumping around in genre. I mean, if you look at the genre work that he's done, it's pretty widespread and a lot of success in all of it. And I feel bad for him. I was delighted that he came back and really got a nice new feather in his cap to be included with The Force Awakens, and I do think you can feel his deft hand on that screenplay. And even though, as we were talking about before, yeah, there's some retread elements to it, it still feels holistic in a lot of ways. It feels natural to the Star Wars universe, and I think it took his touch to do that. I don't know that it would have without him. So I think he's a talented guy. I hope that his relative return with that Han Solo movie means we're going to see a few more from him, whatever it is he wants to do. I'd love to see him do another noir again. I mean, I'm sure we could do another hour on Body Heat, because that's not just one of the best genre exercises or tributes. I think Body Heat, for me, is a top 10 all-time noir. It's marvelous.
It basically started the neo-noir.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where I was. It started the erotic thrillers of the 80s. I mean, you got Sea of Love, Fatal Attraction. I mean, Jesus Christ, how many of those? What was that fucking Nine and a half weeks. I mean, it started that whole like subgenre. Mm-hmm. I felt like, I think Body Heat. I don't even know what my favorite Kasdan movie would be. It'd probably be The Big Chill. But I mean, fuck, Body Heat, I think, is a near perfect film.
Yeah.
Considering it's a quasi remake, and Jason, you're gonna roll your eyes at this, and I gotta plug it. But I didn't know this until I made a post about Body Heat like months ago, and somebody commented on my thread that George Lucas essentially got Body Heat made.
Why am I gonna roll my eyes at?
No, just because I gotta bring Kasdan and Star Wars. You know,
I don't have a problem with Star Wars. I'm not a.
No, I know you don't. I know. We're just being playful with that, but. It's interesting because I always look at Kasdan as two different people. I look at like Star Wars Kasdan, and it's like, holy shit, this guy, you know, Star Wars Indiana Jones Kasdan. It's like, this guy fucking is responsible for two of the greatest trilogies of all time. And then he's got all his own shit where he's a writer director on his own, and it stacks up very well, if not better, artistically and emotionally, to Star Wars and Indiana Jones. But Lucas produced the movie uncreditedly because he didn't want his name to get drawn through an erotic thriller. But essentially he got the movie made with his clout because he loved what Kasdan did so much with Star Wars. And from everything I understand, and I love George Lucas, I'll defend that guy for the fucking rest of my life, but Kasdan was the one who actually wrote Indiana Jones and came up with the whole character and everything. It was just a concept by Lucas that Kasdan just took off with. But anyway, let's get back to Kasdan. Jason or Kyle, whichever one you two.
I like, you know, 7 of the 10 of his films that I've seen, you know, out of the 11 that he's made. as a director. So I guess, you know, it's a fair percentage. I'm leaving The Big Chill out of that because I still, like I said, still haven't seen it recently enough to feel good about saying I like it or dislike it, really, though I don't remember it being a good experience. I think, you know, where Kasdan as a director is concerned, I think his best asset as a director is his writing. He's not much of a visualist, really. I think Silverado might have some of the most interesting visuals of any of his films because of the genre and, you know, what it allows in the history of the genre. But generally, his movies, to me, are tame as far as visually, very well-composed and, you know, competent, but not trying to do a lot necessarily. And he's just so good with large casts in general, with the exception of the movies that I was complaining about before we started recording. but in general, there aren't many directors, particularly in that area, who I think handle a big cast as well as he does. And, you know, I think probably because of what we've touched on already is casting. He just has a knack for casting and for understanding, you know, an actor's personality and how it will fit with the character that he's written and he's, you know, slaved over for however long it takes him to get a screenplay put together. And then building relationships. He has a lot of relationships that, you know, like Hurt and like Clan, where they come back and so they have that chance to grow as collaborators. And I think that's always beneficial for a filmmaker to have a group like that. I kind of like flashy directors, so I can't put Kasdan as like my favorite director of all time, but I respect the guy
right.
for sure, and would definitely continue to, like, if he wants to start making movies again, I'll start seeing him again.
I don't want this to sound like too bold of a statement, but I just kind of want to go off of what you were saying. I almost think that Kasdan is the best writer-turned-director.
Hmm.
One of them. I know Oliver Stone is there, too, because
yeah.
of Oliver Stone, but Oliver Stone really took a shit. I mean, I'm a big defender of Alexander.
Yeah. He's kind of
I know a lot of people don't like that movie. I understand that. But everything post-Alexander is just like... Well, I like the Wall Street sequel solely because it's propped up on nostalgia of the original one, but it has one of the worst fucking endings to a movie I have... The ending to the Wall Street sequel is, like, offensive to anybody who loves the first movie like I do. But, I mean, that could be a whole other podcast. I mean, that could be, like, fucking
sure.
a 13-part sure. podcast series on Oliver Stone, which actually isn't a bad idea. I like a Kasdan podcast series, too. But I think what makes Kasdan's films work, you're right, they're not flashy. I can't think of too many shots, really, from a Kasdan film. The only visuals I really think of when I think about a Kasdan movie is a lot of scenes from, I think probably Body Heat is his most visual movie.
Yeah.
I think of I think of the wind chime scene. I think William Hurt dumping the fucking three ice cubes in the bathtub. But the opening, right, the opening credits to The Big Chill, I think, is probably one of the best opening credits I've ever seen. But anyway, I think what makes his films work so well is he's such a fucking great writer that he knows how to structure a screenplay, and he knows how to cast the right actors to suit his dialogue, and it's just a fucking slow burn of a character-driven film. And even Silverado is that, even with all the action. But anyway, sorry to cut you off, Kyle.
Oh, no, you're fine. I think I'd probably end where Jason's at as far as Kasdan. I have a lot of emotional connection to his films just because I grew up watching them. Like, Big Chill is probably my dad and mom's, like, favorite film because it's them, you know. And so that you know, that soundtrack was on repeat in my house growing up, you know. I like that he's very good with ensembles, but I like that he's also very good with understanding the scope of what he's attempting. Like, he does the big ensemble, but he also does the small intimate piece like Body Heat, Accidental Tourist. I actually really like Accidental Tourist quite a bit.
That's great.
I actually like a lot, aside from Body Heat, I like a lot of the way that film is shot. I like the colors that he uses to kind of simulate the tragedy that's, you know, that they're living through and all that. I love Silverado, love Big Chill. I love Grand Canyon. I'll take I'll take my lumps for it, but that's almost entirely due to the fact that I'm a social worker, and like I love certain aspects of the relationship. It's got tons of warts and all that, but I love the treatment of the friendship between Mac and Simon. And but I think if I had to, it's either Body. I think it's Accidental Tourist. If I had to pick, like right now, that's probably the one. That was one of the first films that I saw where I was kind of starting to understand grief. As a person, like, you know, and it's always kind of haunted me. Like, just certain scenes, I can always think, I'm like, man. But I think, I really hope, I would be very excited to see him attempt something new. Maybe even a different genre, because he's played with so many, like maybe, as far as I'm talking about directing, like a sci-fi or even a horror or something, just something different, because he seems to kind of, he's a dabbler. He's a great writer.
He's done sci-fi and horror. That's a Dreamcatcher right there.
Okay. Aside from the
and that's an ensemble film, yeah, too.
It's got it all.
The masterpiece. If we're talking writers to directors, oh man, that could be a whole series. You know, Mamet, yeah, of course, immediately jumps to my.
Yeah, Mamet, you're right.
To my like top, but yeah, I mean, even Dreamcatcher, because I'll kind of defend it as well. I mean, even a bad quote unquote bad Kasdan film is still like it's an experience, and there are merits to it, to the ones that hit or miss for me. But then again, I'm pretty positive for most of the time. But I just think that he's one of the greats, and I mean, like, I don't know how you couldn't respect what he's done for the medium. I just don't, you know, you can't have a conversation about film in American film that, you know, the 80s, like you're that was great what you were saying about, you know, because like in the 80s, for the most part, it was either you were trying to play off that renegade vibe of the 70s, and that's how a lot of guys made their bone. Alex Cox really comes to mind for me. Or there were people doing the kind of, you know, because that was like the VHS heyday, the slasher film heyday, because everybody jumped on Carpenter, and there was that. But it was either that, or there was people making films like Kasdan made, like these sweeping kind of, you know, not stealing, but very like loving homages, you know, sweet. He's always trying, even in the small scope, even in the noir and the drama, the tragedy, he's always trying to tell something larger than life. And I really like that about him.
I think that is those are all really good points. And I do want to circle back to Dreamcatcher real quick, because I want to say on the air here, as many problems as that movie has, I think that's much more source material than anything Kasdan did. I think if you go back and watch that, knowing that King was coming off of his terrible accident where he almost died, he got hit by a truck, and he was basically on painkillers for a year or whatnot when he wrote that thing, and it all plays like kind of a fever dream of all of Stephen King's stories all happening at the same time.
Right.
And that's a tough row to hoe, you know? And I thought Kasdan actually made a good-looking movie. It's funny at times. It is suspenseful at times. He has a lot of fun working with Damian Lewis, who is just gonzo over the top in that, after he's, you know, invaded by the toilet monsters. And, you know, he's got to deal with toilet monsters. It's like, it's a tough job.
I just
job.
Don't know why.
Really,
why was it Dreamcatcher? Why was it Dreamcatcher? It's like, you couldn't do the Dark Tower. You couldn't do a Dark Tower movie. I mean, I know that the trailer just came out, but I know they've been trying to make the fucking Dark Tower movies for like 15 years too. But Dreamcatcher just seems like such an odd choice for Kasdan to do. I don't know.
I don't think Dark
Guy.
I think they'd adapted everything else major. I used to have a running joke with my friend that they actually would break into King's kitchen and like look around for notes to adapt.
Yeah, I mean, I'm
the
not.
Next one's
I'm not too.
Called. Bob called. He'll call you back. Yeah, like, they're stealing his voicemails and stuff to make scripts, because
I don't think
I'm
Dark
not
Tower
too hip to.
done.
Yeah,
at
I was
that
gonna
point.
Say, I don't know. I don't know the timelines of stuff. I'm not too hip to King's published work, but it just seems like an odd choice. And considering that Kasdan's a writer director, and he's always written his own material for the most part, it just seemed odd to me that he did Dreamcatcher. And I mean, I'm gonna rewatch Dreamcatcher. I saw it in theaters. I saw it in theaters before I really knew who Lawrence Kasdan was. I might have known who he was, but I don't think I have it on DVD. I have to check.
I think one of my, aside from Morgan Freeman's eyebrows, I think one of my favorite parts of the film is that Tom
Sizemore made a porn.
Is once again trapped in a film that he's trying desperately to do something and make it something, you know, and it's just the material dooms him every time. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but in general, poor Tom Sizemore is like always like, oh, I can do these cool things, and I can, you know, and it's like, oh no, but I'm in this movie. But Tim brought up something that I did want to very quickly. It does have some good visuals in it, like the frozen woman in the middle of the road. They do that kind of, you know, that wide pan, and then it kind of focuses in as the vehicle arrives, and the scene of the animals in front of the cabin when they're like, they're not stampeding, but they're like, you know, running away or whatever. And some of the aerial shots when they're like, not the CGI alien thing, but like before that with like the helicopters. There is some pretty cool like visuals in there. I just hadn't thought of it until you said something.
Do you think at any point Disney offered Kasdan to direct the Han Solo movie?
Boy, I don't know.
Because I think it was announced that Kasdan and his son were going to write the movie before they even got the Lego Movies guys. And I can't think of a better person to direct. I mean, I'm sure the Lego Movie guys will be fine.
Yeah.
I think a Star Wars movie is pretty much on autopilot for the most part, unless you're just a fucking idiot. I think they're pretty fairly hard to fuck up. Anyway, dead air.
Some might disagree with that. I totally agree.
Yeah, I know.
I don't want to get into a
prequel discussion. I know.
Yeah, no. I'm just saying there is a huge studio apparatus built around this at this point. You know, that's why we were talking about J.J. Abrams.
Look at the fucking Marvel movies.
I don't even know who half those fucking guys are
that are making these
exactly
movies.
That's exactly right.
You like were plugged and in it's just as a stamp. It's a
studio
fucking
hand.
Template.
Dude,
James Gunn, who's an auteur. I know. I love getting into this fucking discussion where I get into an argument with myself and I get all riled up. This fucking Marvel never hires auteurs except for James Gunn.
Waititi for Ragnarok and Ryan Coogler for Black Panther.
Yeah, I know. I think we talked about it.
Yeah, we did.
Void.
I mean, but in general.
But you're right.
But
you're
Frank's
right.
Frank's favorite guy, Joss Whedon. I mean, if you can't watch the Avengers movies. Yeah, I had the workshop, and there he is. He totally is. If you know all of his stuff and you watch the Avengers movies, that's all Joss. Absolutely. 110%. We'll have that conversation another time.
I wish I could send a GIF of Joaquin Phoenix doing the thumbs down from fucking
Gladiator.
Fucking Gladiator right
the audience
now.
Can't hear it, but here's a GIF.
That's fine. But honestly, though, I do want Kasdan to direct more, and I always felt that him doing a Han Solo movie would be perfect because I don't think it would be like this large-scale fucking explosions everywhere. Granted, there's going to be that in the Han Solo movie, but that feels like that would be a smaller, intimate story to tell. And I always felt that Kasdan, Dreamcatcher notwithstanding, has always been very good at telling a small story on a large scope. And
yeah.
I feel like that's what the Han Solo movie is going to be.
And keeping the action organic, too. Sorry, Jason, I'll shut up in a second. But just, like, to go back to Silverado, how organic is the action throughout? It's constant. That's an action-packed movie. But it never feels like, oh, they got to shove in a horse chase here or something. You
right.
know, it's a,
no.
So, yeah, I agree.
Because he understands the genre. And funny, because I keep hearing that Han Solo might kind of be a Western. Like, that's the route that they're going with this particular offshoot film. So it would make a lot of sense.
I don't know how to feel about it. I mean, you guys know I fucking live and breathe Star Wars, and I was very nervous about Rogue One. That made me feel a whole hell of a lot better. But the Han Solo movie, I was like, why even bother with a Han Solo movie? But then Kasdan is writing it, so it's like, okay, well, the movie's – not going to be terrible because Kasdan is writing it. And, I mean, who knows Star Wars better than Kasdan aside from George Lucas?
Right.
I don't think there's anybody alive that would. And
you?
I mean, yeah.
You
wish.
And maybe
Disney,
Joe Johnston. I wouldn't
Disney just hire me. Just Joe Johnston should do the Boba Fett movie if they're
yes.
actually going to do a Boba Fett movie. But I don't
yes.
know what happened to that after
they
Josh Trank
got fired. Lock, y'all. Don't even bother.
I've always felt that fucking Boba Fett is just like less is more with him, and it's like, what the fuck are you going to do with the whole movie? But anyway, let's move on to our Danny Glover performances so I don't go on another Star Wars ramble, which I would love to the next time we all have a podcast. But it wouldn't be podcasting them softly if I wasn't able to sneak in Star Wars. So anyway, let me pull my list up. And like we were saying earlier, the Danny Glover list was harder than I thought it was going to be. Once I looked at the guy's IMDb, and it was just like, oh, my God, I forgot he was in this. I forgot he was in this. I forgot he was in this.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how I'd forgotten that he was in The Color Purple when he is absolutely magnetic and horrifying in The Color Purple. I mean, that's probably my number one right there. No?
Dude, it's like, no, it's like Color Purple's not even on my list, and I feel so ashamed that it's not even on my list.
On my list.
That's okay.
Not on mine.
We'll bring a good list, a joint list together. How about that? Now,
all right, well,
I have to say my other favorite of his is Lethal Weapon.
All right, we're doing top
two.
Okay, hang on now.
What? Oh,
Jim, we're going to do top five in descending order.
All right.
So why don't you start since you've already spoiled two of your picks?
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Well,
thank you.
Color Purple, I'm probably going to say, is number one. Lethal Weapon
okay,
2
descending. That's
is
fine.
Number two because he's literally taking a number two. He should get, like, a special Oscar for, like, best scene performed while about to die on a toilet. Nobody else can fucking lay claim to that, okay? That's a special Oscar right there. Witness is probably my number three. It's a smaller role, and it's almost dialogue-free. But again, like in Color Purple, the menace is just palpable every time he's on the screen. And, you know, he's horrifying in that. That's one of my favorites of the 80s anyway. I'm going to put Silverado in there at four because I really like the story. I was going to say there is kind of a sad historical accuracy to what happens to him and his family. That's exactly what happened to people of color who tried to get the hell out of the South and places like that and go west, paid their dues, tried to just, you know, farm a piece of land, and people would just keep coming and stealing from them, murdering them, whatnot. So I appreciated that, sad as it is, that part of Silverado, and I thought he has a pretty good kind of quiet, noble gravitas to that. And then, let's see, at number five, I would probably say To Sleep With Anger. Have you guys seen that one?
I haven't seen that, no.
I saw it a long, long time ago, so I'm not just flush with details, but I want to see it again now because he plays a guy who finds some old friends. There are all of his friends. They're all from the South, but man and wife have moved to L.A., and he shows up on their doorstep, and they just are so glad to see him, and they invite him in, and he just starts fucking with their family and ratcheting up tension. He is not a good person to be put into their home. And again, it's kind of a villainous role, but he embraces it with glee. It's a lot of fun. So anyway, that's my top.
I hope this is available to watch somewhere.
Oh, I think it is. It came out in 90, so it's probably available.
Okay.
It's actually kind of hard to find.
Oh, what's that?
It's actually kind of hard to find.
Is it? Huh.
Yeah.
Well, it was an indie movie, you know. It was definitely an indie movie, so
yeah,
that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, worth checking out.
Yeah, definitely worth checking out.
All right, Jason, what are yours?
Well, I'll start right there because my number one, if we're going in descending order, is To Sleep With Anger. This performance, it is horrific without really any effort. The story is so – it's such an interesting story because there's a lot – the family that you know Tim mentioned who's from the South, who's moved away – they're very superstitious, very religious, not overtly any kind of religion, but just a lot of superstition, you know, throwing salt, don't touch me with a broom, all this kind of weird stuff that, you know, nobody really understands. So Harry, I think that's his name, Harry, comes in.
Yeah, that's his name, Harry.
Okay. So Harry comes into the situation And at first, it's all love. It's all like, oh my gosh, we haven't seen you in years. This is so exciting. And you know, it's like old friends get back together. But he quickly kind of insinuates himself, and it's not. There's always kind of this like, is he like evil in like kind of a possessed kind of religious way, or is he just a bad influence? And the movie just kind of walks this line where it's almost a horror movie sometimes. You think it could go that way, but it never really pushes it, and it just becomes this drama about your past and not being able to let things go, and you know, not being able to change, but kind of with this weird supernatural thing, kind of always in the corner or always over your shoulder. And it's such a great performance from Glover. I'll go back to the physicality we were talking about earlier. He's super jovial, but he's got this menace to him constantly, where you feel like at any moment he could just kind of annihilate everyone in the room, in a biblical sense, or just by, you know, in a human kind of sense of just being forceful and violent. I really, really highly recommend trying to seek that out.
Just to interject, you can rent it or buy it, or you can buy it on Amazon Prime.
Are you looking at it right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
This poster is fucking amazing, and it makes me want to watch the movie like right now.
It's just the poster of him?
Fucked up. It's the poster of him holding like the pictures of the family. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he looks like fucking Pennywise.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a great poster. But it's a tremendous performance, and one of the most, I think, subtle and complex of his performance. But I'll move on, or else I'll just keep talking about that. So number two, I put today's movie, Silverado. I think Malachi Mal is such a strong character amongst, you know, a group of strong characters that, I mean, I don't really have anything. I can't really add anything that we haven't already kind of said. So I'll just move on. What did I have for number three? I kind of cheated, I guess, because I'm just going to say it. Roger Murtaugh. I was almost not going to put him on here because I felt it was more of like a nostalgia pick, because I just seen particularly the first two with Lethal Weapons so many times as, you know, an adolescent and teenager. But it's, you know, it's a great iconic character that I would feel bad not including in this list. Number four. This is where it gets a little sticky for me, because both my four and my five are movies that I think have a lot of problems in, you know, overall, but his performance in each is really great. Number four is The Color Purple, where he plays Mr., or as we later discover, Albert. And again, it's this kind of this air of menace that he carries with him, particularly in the first half of the movie. And then later, when his love Shug, who's not with her or anything, but she comes back and he kind of gets neutered a little bit. He's a little disarmed as a character from then on in the movie. While he does, you know, he does become violent again and goes back and forth a little bit. At that point, he kind of things start to change with him as a character, and you see, you know, not the softer side, but you see a vulnerable side, and you know, Glover, being as good as he is able to convey both the madness and the vulnerability with such ease. So it's another just fantastic performance. And then my fifth, I'll be surprised if either of you guys have this on here. I really was like, I shouldn't put this on there. It's not really a good movie, but his performance is so much fun, and he has so much fun with it. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but Jeb Stuart's thriller from the late 90s, Switchback.
Switchback, that's fun. That's on my
Switchback's list. On my list.
I'm very happy.
I knew you were going to say it.
I don't think
Switchback. I know. I'm like, I want to be the guy that says Switchback. I'm like, the way you let in with everything, I'm like, fuck. Jason's going to steal my fucking moment in the sun.
I love that performance. It's so hilarious. And again, it's
great.
Again, it's like this menacing character that he just kind of just eats it up. But this one is like even kind of more ridiculous, kind of cartoonish in a way, in a lot of ways, actually, with his pimp ride with the lady, the naked upholstery. But, you know, again, the movie itself as a whole, I have a lot of problems with. You know, Jeb Stuart was another writer turned director who, you know, wrote a lot of great, you know, 80s action movies, or, you know, at least decent ones. and this was his first job as a director, and it's almost a little overwritten, I would say. It's just really contrived at times, but damn, is Danny Glover fun. He's so fun, and his death is like one of my favorite deaths in all of cinema. Like, cheerfully, like, it's, you know, it's kind of like Captain Kong from Strangelove, just gleefully riding death to the
right,
riding into oblivion. So yeah, there's my five.
All right, I'll do mine then, Kyle. Kyle, I know you and I are going to have a special one in common on here. My number one is Silverado. We beat the movie to death. He's amazing in it. He's got the best lines, two of the best lines, I think, in the movie. My second pick, and I'm with Jason on this one, is Lethal Weapon. It's a nostalgia pick, and I struggled with putting it on there. Realistically, A Color Purple probably should have been in the spot of Lethal Weapon, but Lethal Weapon is just too big of a performance of his, and it's probably his most... It's got to be his most well-known and probably important to his career. Number three is going to be Grand Canyon. The movie does have some issues. I still like it a lot. I think he's the best part of the movie. Thank you, Kyle. And then number four is Switchback, because I often feel like I've never seen Dennis Quaid in a good movie. Like, you know, I like Dennis Quaid. I think he's a good actor. He's a good looking dude. He's got act, but he's never been in anything where it's like, wow. I could be wrong. I'd have to like actually go over his list. Is he in The Right Stuff? He could be in The Right
Stuff. He is in The Right Stuff.
Okay, so I retract it, but I think you guys know where I'm going with that. It's like, poor Dennis Quaid. It's like, he just can never, like, pick those movies. But anyway,
better than
I like...
Randy Quaid.
At least Randy Quaid was in, like, Brokeback Mountain, though. I don't know how the fuck that happened, but Randy Quaid was in Brokeback
Mountain.
Thank God
he wasn't one of the leads. I'll just leave that out there. Anyway.
Oh, homophobe. But yeah, Switchback's a lot of fun for what it is, if you take it for what it is. And then number five is a tie, because I had to fit both of these in here. Fucking, I won't say much about it because Kyle's going to run away with it, but fucking Predator 2 is amazing. I love Predator 2. It's one of the shitty great movies, the shittiest great movies I've ever seen in my entire life. I love everything about it. I love that it takes place in, like, what, 1997? And it's in the fucking, you know, in the future, and they're driving around in minivans. The fucking cop cars are like minivans. I mean, it's just, you know, and Danny Glover's so good in it. And the whole movie's just out of place. But Danny Glover carries the shit out of this just train wreck of a movie that is just amazing. And him calling the Predator Pussyface is my favorite Predator moment, even including the first movie. And then that's tied with Witness. Witness, I don't know if the first thing I ever saw him in when I was a little kid was either Lethal Weapon or Witness, but when I watched Witness when I was younger, because I was obsessed with Harrison Ford because he was Indiana Jones and Han Solo, that was one of the first rated R movies my mom let me watch, and he scared the fucking shit out of me in that movie when I was a little kid. He's just fucking death
mm-hmm.
in that movie. He doesn't fuck around. I think he's got like three lines of dialogue. But you just know he is a fucking stone killer in that movie. And that entire performance is birthed off of his physicality and the way he moves in front of the camera, and I think he's remarkable. Mm-hmm. So that's my top five. I do want to give an honorable mention, obviously, to The Color Purple, but I struggled with this on my list. I wanted to put it on my list, but I don't think it's that great of a movie, and I kind of hate the franchise that it spawned, but I think he is tremendous in the first Saw movie. He's the only reason I ever want to really go back and watch that movie, because that first movie's kind of a shit show when it comes to a lot of the performances. The movie's really not that good, but I think he's great in that movie, and I almost wish that he would play another character like that in a better movie that's got better writing and direction to it. But I love that he was that like rage-filled cop bent on fucking justice/vengeance to try and find the killer. I loved his character in that movie, and I thought he was the perfect guy to anchor it. So that's my top five. Kyle?
My number one is Predator 2, without a doubt. I It's such a train wreck. It's a complete train wreck. But it's just, it's a movie that just won't ever be made again like that. You know, like, and it's dystopian and it's funny and it's totally playing on things that is now we're now living in. And Danny Glover was like, I can carry the action film. I can do it. Let me do it. And he tried to do it. And it's Danny Glover in an action film. That's not Lethal Weapon. And I love the costuming. I love the culture, the world they build. I think it's absolutely hilarious. I think if it had been labeled anything besides Predator 2, it would have been much more well received. but I love his performance. My favorite scene is actually where he's staring down Gary Busey in the police thing, and he's like just staring at him, and he just slaps his hands together in front of his face and like walks away. That playoff between the two of them.
I love your passion for this movie. I own it on Blu-ray, by the way.
So do I. I prefer it to the first. I know I'm a heathen, but it's just for me, it's just a fun movie. It's like when I want to watch something where I'm going to laugh. You can literally time his appearance with an egg timer in that film. Like, it's like, oh, it's been 2 minutes. We need Danny Glover to show up and fight the Predator. And it's like, damn, he shows up with some crazy cool guns. And it's just, you know, Ruben Blades and Maria Conchita Alonso and Bill Paxton. I mean, who, you know, completes the trifecta by being killed by a predator. It's just a fun film, but I'll stop. My second is Grand Canyon, for reasons I already mentioned. My third would be Lethal Weapon for basically what you guys have said. The only other thing that I would mention that I really like about him particularly is that you could see him being he is Riggs if Riggs' wife doesn't get killed. Because in the end, like when they take his daughter and, you know, Gibson's like, you know, we're gonna get bloody, shoot to kill, that whole monologue, it's like he gets into that zone. Like he faces down those dudes, throws a grenade, you know, he's taking the torture and he's like, I'm gonna kill you, and he ends up going right to that spot. And then the final scene, you know, where he's like holding everybody off while they're doing the title fight and all that, I love the idea that he, you know, he has the killer in him, but he left it behind because he, you know, made a family, but it's still there. And that's, I don't want to get too far off thing, but that's like one of my things I love about No Country for Old Men is how it talks about when you've been exposed to violence, that kind of lives in your heart forever, and it's like right there, and like, you know, just it's just two different paths, and I love the contrast between the two of them. But I think ultimately that's what's the bridge between the two characters and why it works so well as a buddy cop film.
That's a very astute observation. I never looked at Lethal Weapon like that.
Thank you. My number four is kind of a cheat. It's a cameo-ish kind of performance, but I love it. The Rainmaker. He's the judge. Basically shuts down John Voight's corporate, you know, motion denied. I love everything about his charisma, and he's like, hey, I'm Danny Glover, I'm doing this thing. And then my number five would be Switchback for all of the reasons that you guys mentioned. I think the thing that it's clearly a train wreck of a film, but he is having so much fun.
Oh yeah,
chewing up every scene he's in. At just the encounters are ridiculous. Like when he's in the store with the woman, and just every time something about that death scene is just so it's awesome. And that was when everybody was kind of capitalizing on the serial killer.
Exactly.
Boom. And this was one of the lesser ones, but it's still memorable because of his performance. And then all the other films, of course, are right there. I mean, these are personal, like, just,
oh, of course,
you know, preferences. I would probably say Color Purple is probably his best if I had to pick one. But these are the ones that I specifically, Predator 2, that gets a lot of play in my house, just because it's just pure magic to me that it even got made. Like I look at it after, I'm like, how did they even? It's like we go from Arnie in the Jungle to, all right, gang wars.
It's like Predator 2 got greenlit because Schwarzenegger was going to come back, and then all of a sudden he dropped out of it, and it's like, oh fuck, our budget's gone. We got $2 million. What the fuck are we going to do?
Yeah, and I don't.
And then somebody raises their hand in the room, and they're like, how about Danny Glover?
And I don't want to get too into it because we've got that project we've been toying with, but there was a lot of those weird films with weird choices, like Free Jack is another one that comes to mind.
Yeah, Free Jack.
Like, you have this, like, sci-fi, dystopian kind of thing, but then you have Emilio Estevez and Mick Jagger. Like, Anthony Hopkins, it's just, like, I love weird casting choices. Like, they don't always work. They don't always work, but I love, that's why I like Switchback. It's like, I love when people, like, I'm sad to see that the Circle is getting utterly destroyed. Not that I'm surprised based on what I saw, but I was excited because I was like, is Tom Hanks playing a for real villain? Like a for real villain? Like, I love when people break out of their comfort zone. And so that's why I really enjoy those films by Glover.
Well, awesome. That wraps up our Silverado, Danny Glover, Lawrence Kasdan, Gush Fest. The four of us will put our heads together and we'll come back and do another Kasdan movie. We'll make it a series, an auteur series.
Perfect.
Sounds great.
Sounds good to me.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jason. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and thanks for coming on our podcast, man.
Hey, man, thanks for the invite again. I really appreciate it. And, yeah, let's continue this. I'll even watch some bad Kasdan movie just for the opportunity to talk.
You know what we should do? We should all watch Darling Companion and then do a podcast on it, since none of us have seen it.
That's
his last
true statement.
Movie.
Yeah. Sure.
I would be willing to do that.
And we all love Kasdan, so we should do that.
Sounds
that's
good.
What our next Kasdan podcast is going to be. And then if that movie's underwhelming and we're trying very hard to sell it, even though it's probably not that, I don't know. I don't know what it's going to be like. We'll come back with Body Heat after that one.
And a Kasdan thing that I just realized, Kasdan did Wyatt Earp, didn't he?
Yes.
He did.
Dennis Quaid.
I can't believe none of us thought of that.
Was one of the big bombs. I mean, I think that's one of the ones that really torpedoed his career, even though in retrospect it's really kind of grown in esteem.
It's not that bad. It had the disadvantage of coming out almost exactly the same time as Tombstone. Which
everybody thought Tombstone was going to be shitty. Everybody thought Tombstone was going to be shitty, and the Lawrence Kasdan, Kevin Costner Western about Wyatt Earp was going to be the fucking...
Right.
Dude, that movie, I almost brought that up when I was talking about Dennis Quaid.
I was going to say, Dennis Quaid, Doc Holliday.
Dennis Quaid's good in that movie, but then anytime you say Doc Holliday, you think of Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
And it's just like, fucking Dennis Quaid's like 80 pounds in that movie, dude.
Yeah.
But here's... Oh, we should really do Wyatt Earp, because you know why? This is an ensemble piece that's like kind of a misfire, because you got like Mark Harmon and fucking Tom Sizemore playing Bat Masterson and whoever the fuck else, and then you got Michael Madsen playing like Virgil Earp, and it's like I love all these actors, but like, no. I have to rewatch it. I have the Blu-ray. We should really do this. I really want to rewatch it, but I felt like there's a good portion of that didn't work. I may feel differently now watching it, but fuck, he did Wyatt Earp. I totally forgot. And you're right, Tim. I mean, that was his fucking Waterworld, man.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. Yeah.
Waterworld's awesome, by the way.
Oh, of course.
But,
well, Joss
Whedon,
you know, did some work on the screenplay, so of course it was.
Are you making that up?
Not making that up at all. No, he called it, like, the best month-long free Hawaiian vacation he ever got. They brought him in, and they were like, help fix this. And he was like, this is fucked. Here's some pages. They didn't use any of it. They didn't use any of it.
That's like Michael Caine talking about Jaws the Revenge. He's like, the Bahamas was really fun, and I can show you the house it paid for.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right, well, we'll figure it out. I don't know. We'll do something, and we'll make an announcement. But, yeah, the four of us will be back to do another Kasdan movie.
Awesome.
Can I add one more thing
about Glover?
Yes.
Since you did an honorable mention, I want to mention Beloved by Jonathan Demme, who we lost last week, which is a really, really interesting film. Maybe not perfect, definitely not perfect, but another really strong performance from Glover, a more sensitive, less menace. So if you're looking for less menace out of your Glover, look for Beloved.
And that's where Jonathan Demme continued his tradition of not giving a fuck and making the movie he wanted to make.
Always.
Yeah.
And that's why we all love Jonathan Demme.
Right. Well, when you have that Harpo money coming at you,
that helps.
So you can make the movie you want. Right.
Right on. All right.
All right. Well, that's it. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot, man. Talk to you soon.